sounds very nice. Thanks very much. My name is Mary Jane Roy, and I am an alcoholic. It's been such a terrific weekend. I have really enjoyed it. Even though this was hanging over my head, I still had a really good time hanging out with everybody. It's been great. I do appreciate that the committee, and Jeanette is who I talked with, and I thank you very much for thinking of me and asking me to come. And Maggie, thanks so much. And the people in hospitality, and most especially, it's Tammy has taken such good care of me, and we've just had a good time this weekend, and it will be a lasting impression for me of pockets of enthusiasm on Cape Cod. I'd heard of this conference before, but it almost always fell at the same time as the Rhode Island State Convention, so I was always on the hook for that. And this year we lost our hotel and the dates got changed, so it's been very fortunate for me. I got to come down here. And as I say, Rhode Island, that's where I live. My home group is the Friday Night Big Book Group that meets in Kingston, Rhode Island, and you're all welcome. Not all at once, but I love my home group and I'm proud of it. And that's where I grew up. I grew up in Rhode Island. I grew up in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. There was a play. It was in Damn Yankees. One of Lola's lines was, they said, "What did you do before, you know, she turned into Lola?" And she said, "I was the ugliest girl in Pawtucket, Rhode Island." I've laughed about that for years. Let's see. I always have kind of a problem to get rolling here. My growing up wasn't anything big to make any kind of note of. My parents were really nice people. I had one sibling. I have a brother who's 5 years younger than I, who I tormented pretty bad and was one of the very first ones on my amends list. My mother was a lovely, good lady and tried very hard. My dad was an active alcoholic, but I was just crazy about him. He was a great, big, handsome Irishman. He was 6'2" and silver-tongued, and I just loved him dearly. And in my very early years, this is, I think, kind of interesting, before I'd ever had a sip of beer, my mother, when she was really upset with me, would say something like, "You're just like your father." And I took that as a real compliment, but that's not what she was saying at the time. But she could see it coming a long ways off. And now that I have kids, you can see them coming a long ways off, you know. When I was 12 years old, my dad got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And things really changed. I'm not here to tell you his story, but an interesting observation that I'd like to report is that the year before he got to AA, my dad had 12 jobs, and he was a very intelligent man. He drank his way out of college, but he was very smart, and he was loading boxes on a freight dock towards the end, and he got to Alcoholics Anonymous and spent the next 25 years at one job. I think that's very dramatic. You know, we say things like, "Oh, we change so slowly and gradually." Yeah, we do. But look at the change. You know, it's amazing. One day we're absolutely hopeless, crapped up drunks, and from the time that we begin a recovery process in this program, it is dramatically different. Usually we point to things like that, like a job or a car, I got a new house, I got a raise. But the truth of it is way on the inside where the big, big, big changes come. And those are very difficult to describe. I've always had trouble with that. I want to be able to tell someone new what it has meant for me personally to have had this go on in my life. And I'm stuck for words. And I wind up telling them about my friends or about my stuff, but But way down deep inside, where, like what I could see in my father, a man who had lost all self-respect and was just absolutely down and out. That's devastating to a person, to a human. But for all of that to be able to turn around and for me to see it was very dramatic. Because of his coming into AA, I felt like I was the local authority on alcoholism. I took it on myself to explain alcoholism and chronic drinking and just all kinds of stuff like that. And also, I kind of picked up a lot of the jargon. We were talking last night at dinner whether locally new guys are called a pigeon or a baby, or, you know, those vary geographically. And I can remember when my mother would say, well, we've got to finish dinner early tonight. Dad's got a pigeon. So I grew up knowing what a pigeon was and all that stuff. And, or somebody was coming to the house. I was 11 or 12. I knew to go put the coffee on. It's just part of my growing up. I didn't start to get messed up with my own alcoholism until in high school. And it was just penny ante drinking, nothing big or flashy. And summers I worked over at Block Island. And the summer culture over there was all bellhops and truck drivers and waitresses and night clerks and all that stuff. It was a whole subculture. There was the vacation crowd, and then there were all of the college-age kids that worked there. And we drank a lot, but it was all party drinking. I thought it was terrific. I didn't see it as a problem. And then I got on to college. One thing did begin in college, and that was kind of a shift in priorities. What should have been important to me, which was an education and getting to my classes and doing what I was supposed to be doing there, that took a back seat. You know, it turned out to where I was pretty much killing time between weekends. And the weekends were what I lived for. And the partying got heavier and heavier, and I started physically to show some signs. What Clancy went through is throwing up last night. I thought, you know, that got me through years, because I really did not want to get bad, out-of-control, sloppy drunk. So the solution was throw up. I threw up all the time because I wanted to keep drinking. And that doesn't, I can't believe that would make sense to regular people. So, you know, it's just like the cake with me. I don't throw up food. I don't understand that. But that was just routine for me. By my junior year in college, I had gotten so messed up, though, that I wasn't going to class. I wasn't buying books. I wasn't present. And I was also routinely suicidal. I was into kind of trying to get attention, and everything was a big drama. And I had all these excuses for why I wasn't doing very well. And I thought that ought to satisfy you. You know, if I had a fancy enough excuse, then you ought to say, oh, poor dear, you know. And I started getting threatened that I wasn't going to be allowed to stay in school, and that kind of panicked me, but I didn't do very well with that, with the panic. And I went to one of the administrators. And I had some work due, long overdue, and I went to her, and this was one of my better excuses. I went to her, and I told her about how seriously my life was messed up. My parents were divorcing, and I was deeply depressed about things like that, and my big flashy closer was that I was actually suicidal. And I had swallowed iodine that week, but I did that all the time. I did all kinds of dopey stuff like that. My head in the oven, you know. I really did stuff like that. But she was, you know, a responsible person. This panicked her. She thought, you know, we can't have this going on in the school. So she ratted me out. they had this big meeting, and they called me in and said that I was going to be allowed to drop out of school for personal reasons. Well, that was not my script. I knew what she was supposed to say, and she didn't do it. And so I was out of ideas, and I was out of school, and it wasn't my plan. And there was a girl who I was in school with who really wanted to be an airline stewardess real bad, and she was leaving school to go be a stewardess. And so I rode in on the bus with her one night while she went to make her application. So I made an application, and I got hired. And it was a good thing, because I really did not have plan B. I'd never been on an airplane. But I didn't have anything else cooking, so I went off to school to be a stewardess with Eastern Airlines. And I got to tell you, I really loved that. It was a lot of partying and a lot of fun and a lot of you know, the whole reckless abandon, whatever. It was a lot of fun, and I really did enjoy it a lot. But my drinking was really cooking by now. What you could notice about this point would be I was into blackouts and cars. I had a lot of trouble with cars. I hit, as best I can recall, 11 or 12 other cars, some occupied and moving, some not, and one house. In a bridge abutment. And that, you know, years and years later, I want to tell you this because it's typical of my attitude at the time. It was a date, and I was really bad drunk, but everybody else was pretty bad too. But it was always my job to try. I always felt like as long as I acted sober, I was pulling it off. I always felt like I was getting away with it. And I was doing my act sober business, and I convinced them that I should be the one to drive home. And they bought it and gave me the keys. And so I drove this guy, and we were headed back to the house, and I smashed us into this cement bridge abutment. We were seriously hurt. He was way more hurt than I, and totaled the car. And later on that week, he called me to see if I could take him to the doctor to have some stitches taken out. And I thought that was such an imposition. I mean, I had things to do, you know. It was appalling when that all came back to me, and I remembered how I had been put out by the fact that, I mean, even though I had endangered his life, smacked him up terrible bad, totaled his car, and didn't feel as though he should have called me to inconvenience me to go get his stitches taken out. I don't know. But that really is how my mind worked. And when I started getting threatened at work about missing flights, this is very messy when you're an airline stewardess. You know, like if you work in an office, we all know ways to get into the building if you're running a little late. You know, you know, the back door, the side door, you know, you leave your coat in the car so people think that you've been in the building along more than you have been. We all know that. But if your job is an airplane, you know, and you get there and you're late, it's gone. And it's very noticeable, and it really disrupts things very much. And so I was not able to finesse any of that. I didn't get away with any of that. And so I got written up a lot, and I got called in a lot. And there again, they inconvenienced me. I would have to go down to the post office to get these registered, certified letters. I just was very put out with all that. And my feeling about it was, geez, you know, I really do a good job when I go. And I didn't understand why they were so upset about all of that. ultimately, they really had to let me go. And they said, you know, we realize, Mary Jane, a lot of very bad things have happened to you. You know, a lot of sickness, bizarre illnesses, and broken bones even. If I wanted a weekend off, I'd drop something on my foot. You know, I did things like that, and break a toe so I could just have the days off. They bought a lot of my excuses. Their point was that they just needed somebody there. And that was hard for me to imagine, but I got a better job, as a matter of fact, it very strangely. And it was a sales job. And I didn't think I could do sales, but the truth of it is, if I could sell them on hiring me, I was pretty good, because I'd just gotten canned, you know, from Eastern. And what I told them was that they had made an example of me at Eastern. And it was just an unfortunate circumstance, you know, I just got caught up into this thing. So this job was fantastic. It was to be a sales representative. I was with Eastern for 6.5 years. And then this company, they gave me a new car every other year, which I also wrecked. And I was to be a sales representative, and they gave me a 5-state territory, and it was around Baltimore. So I went to live in Annapolis, Maryland. And in one way, I saw the end of my life when Eastern fired me, because there was a period of time there where I really did have to take a look at my circumstances. Not for long, but it was very bad. I was deeply, deeply depressed, and I was scared, and some other bad things. I was about 27 years old, and my life was really crapped up. But I got this new job, and I got to Annapolis, and I got an apartment, and I got off doing this job. And it was like we were talking about last night, about how there seemed to be periods, brief, of recovery, always followed by a worse relapse. But I had a lot of those little things where you move, or somebody new comes into your life, or some new different thing happens, and somehow or another you get some like a reprieve, and you shape up for a little while, and you think, well, that was just a bad spell I was going through, but it's going to be fine. I'm really going to be okay. And I got that feeling, and I started doing a great job. And then it was so little time. The times of that reprieve got less and less and less. And this was a very brief time where all of a sudden I was in this apartment in Annapolis, all holed up, all by myself. More and more people were missing from my life. I just let them go. I didn't keep up with my family. They just got used to not hearing from me. And I was just totally irresponsible. A thing came back to me this morning. I remember it was a pretty big family of aunts and uncles and cousins. There were a lot of weddings and wakes and stuff. I never showed up at stuff like that. I would tell people that I was going to be there, and I just wouldn't make it. And two of them were family weddings that I was in. I didn't go. You know, something else would come up. Or I wasn't in shape enough that I could make it. But that was the way I lived. So that people didn't bother with me, because why would you pay attention to somebody like that? It went downhill from there. It was important to me how things looked. I kept trying to hold my little act together. But it was tougher and tougher. Physically, I was pretty beat out. I had always drank a lot, and eventually that really does catch up with you. Physically, my nervous system was shot. Part of this territory that I was supposed to cover was across the Bay Bridge to the eastern shore of Maryland. I couldn't drive across the bridge. I had to drive up to Baltimore and all the way around, because I just couldn't do bridges anymore. Nervous system was just shot. I managed to get pregnant around this time. I'm not sure exactly how, believe it or not. But I physically I was so beat out that I wasn't in good enough shape to support life, the pregnancy. I lost the pregnancy. I went to a gynecologist who was very kind to me. He was really nice to me, and he tried to talk to me. It was, and then I started really looking for more help through this. I was with Hollister for about 3 years, and through that time, I would look for help, but not seriously, and I wouldn't ever tell anybody how bad it really was. You know the Jelinek chart? Anybody who's ever been in a treatment facility, it goes down and down and down and down, and it absolutely documents the course of my life. Every single one of those things. When I first got sober and I looked at that chart, I thought, well, maybe one or two. The longer I'm sober and I'm accurately seeing back then, I hit every stop along the way. All of the things that happened to an active alcoholic, I managed to touch. When it gets down to the bottom, it just goes around and around and around and around. And I kept saying, I can't go on like this. I can't live this way. And it was so sad that I would kind of moan and I would play sad music. Frank Sinatra's Only the Lonely was one of my very favorite things. And I would just cry like a wounded animal in my apartment and drink and cry. And there was something wonderful about that. I loved it. I would drink. And I would call out to God, why did you make me like this? And I'd just drink till I passed out and start again the next day and around and around and around. And I traveled these five states for this company, and I couldn't get out of the house on Monday. And I'd get cranked up usually around Tuesday, and I'd make a couple of calls. And I'd get to the hotel, and I'd phony up all of Monday's reports and a couple for Tuesday. And I'd get something to eat, and I'd come back, and I'd drink till I passed out. And you know what? I really loved that. I was very comfortable with that. I would probably still be out there doing exactly that. But alcoholism progresses. And pretty soon I couldn't keep it hung together at all. And I'd called in with all the bizarre excuses that I could muster. And I couldn't manage. I went to a psychiatrist. I was looking for help there. He put me on some stuff that put me down farther, and I would just walk around crying all the time. And then have these totally immobilizing depressions on the weekend. Just drink and cry and pass out and drink and cry and pass out. And then whatever of the week I was able to manage, I would get my butt out of the house but it was just all closing in. There weren't people that I was talking to at all, not my family. I would have told you that I had friends. I would have told you that I loved sailing. I hadn't been on a boat in years. All my interests were out the window. I didn't care about anything. My whole world had gotten so small and awful. It was crappy. I don't know how to tell you what it was, but one day I got up off the couch. I bypassed the kitchen. The kitchen was where I went to get another drink. And I walked past the kitchen. I went into the bedroom and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 28. As best I could tell, life was over. I could not keep it together. I could not not drink. No matter what I said to myself in the morning, like, you know, Mary Jane, you don't seem to be physically doing so well. You'd probably feel better if you didn't drink today. Okay, good idea. I'm not going to drink today. And I would go till about 3. Around 3, I would start to get itchy. And then it would start. As soon as it started in my head, I didn't know this until much later, but as soon as it started, I'd lost the battle. When the argument started in my head, I would always convince myself that I was going to drink again someday, so I might as well do it now. You know, why suffer, for crying out loud? And or some other reason, like well, you know, here it was 3 o'clock. There's no problem. So if there's no problem, why not ever drink? So no matter what I said to myself in the morning, by 4:30, 5 o'clock, I had a drink in my hand. By then I drank every day, not the daily drinking, but that whole business of thinking that I was in control of it, I think that is alcoholism. I had no more chance against the drink than, you know, overcoming the waves of the ocean. It was more than I could manage, and I didn't know that. I really thought that I was changing my mind. I wasn't changing my mind. That's alcoholism. By then, I really was drinking every day, and I was drinking in the morning. I was waking up to drink. I had had alcoholic seizures. I had had DTs, and I didn't even know it until I was sober a while, and I heard people in a meeting talking about DTs. I thought, oh my God, that's what that was. And I certainly wouldn't have admitted to that, you know. That's not the way I saw myself. distorted view, boy. But when I called AA, it happened very quickly for me. I thought, I got relief right away. A lady answered the telephone. I found out later that in those days in Annapolis, there wasn't an intergroup or a central office or anything like that. There was a couple, and he was the alcoholic, and they had a telephone in their home. And this nice lady answered the phone and gave me directions and stuff. And I really tried to act like I didn't really need to be calling. You know, I was just getting some information, like when was there a meeting. And that night was a men's stag. This was in October or November of 1967. And she said, well, you know, there was a regular open meeting that I could go to the following night. So I did not drink. I think that's extraordinary. I think that's amazing. I didn't drink the rest of that day. I didn't drink that night. I didn't drink the next morning or the next day. And I went to the meeting. And from the minute I walked in, I hear people say, you know, and then I was home. I don't know about that. But I know I was safe. And I know that I started talking to people easily, comfortably, right away. I think that's amazing. After being holed up like an animal, what I did though, and this is what I do, I wanted the outside to look good, so I tried to act like the hostess. Like it wasn't a big problem, I just was there, you know? And I would kind of flit in at 8 o'clock, and I would flit back out at the amen. Oh, no, it was after 8. I never got anywhere on time. But I kind of waltzed around, how are you doing? Just great. And people would give me their telephone numbers, and I would say, oh, thank you so much. I had no intention of ever calling anybody. And they would say, have you got a sponsor? And I'd say, well, no, really, my dad is my sponsor. He's sober 20-some years, which he was at that point, but I hadn't talked to him in a couple of years. And I really had this in the back of my mind that I should get to start at kind of an intermediate level. because of my dad, and I knew all these words and stuff. I knew what the deal was. And you know what? That was, part of that was because my reservation, I knew enough not to say this out loud. I didn't think I was like everybody else. Underneath, I thought, not just because of my dad, I thought I was a little different. I thought if I kept going, there was a chance I could become an alcoholic. So, like I say, I knew better than to say that out loud, but I really did think I was different. And so if you had to have a sponsor, then you really probably ought to do that, and you ought to read that book, and you ought to do some of that stuff, and you ought to get to a lot of meetings. I, on the other hand, Anyway, the inevitable result of that, I can report to you, is I got taken terrible bad drunk, and I didn't mean to. And it was about 5 or 6 months after I came in. And it really, this fortunately threw me for a loop. I saw the gates closing, and I was on the wrong side of the gates. I couldn't live in the world, and now I couldn't live in AA either. I wasn't making it anywhere. And that, for me, was a very important day. It was May 4th of 1968. I went to a meeting the following day. I prayed fervently on the way to the meeting that if I was shown what to do and shown who to ask to be my sponsor, I would ask them and I would do whatever they said. And I went to the meeting and I was shown clearly who to ask. It was a retired Navy captain in Annapolis. We had tons of those. And admirals, everybody in Annapolis. But this man was a very orderly, stable, sane man. So obviously I'd had nothing to do with him for those previous 6 months, nor he me. You know, I was just a flake. And I went up to him after that meeting. I knew clearly that's who I had to ask to be my sponsor. He said, well, he would have to check with his sponsor because of my being female, and that I would have to get a co-sponsor, a female co-sponsor, but that he would make an appointment with me for Saturday morning, and he would come to my house, and he gave me the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, and he outlined some stuff, and he circled some stuff, and he said, we'll discuss it on Saturday morning. And so meantime, he called his sponsor, who was a guy named Paul B. from Washington, D.C., Paul's sponsor was a guy named Buck Doyle, who was from Baltimore. Buck's sponsor was Bill Wilson. And when Mac took me on and agreed to be my sponsor, if I would agree to all of those conditions, he said, he talked to me about the chain and for me to not break that chain. He treated everything like that with such respect for our program. I did agree to all of his conditions because I was scared. And he had me call every day, and I really didn't want to do all of that stuff, but fortunately I was afraid enough. He had me report to him on the coincidences that occurred in my life. And every day I had to just tell him some of the funny things that happened. And it wasn't that odd that such a nice thing had happened. Then one day, I was traveling. I was leaving Baltimore. I was going to Pennsylvania. I reached behind the seat to get my jacket, and it was gone. And I pulled over, and then I realized that my car had been broken into. My suitcase, the clothes, everything had been taken. And I got so upset, and I got really mad, and I thought, you know, I'm trying hard. I'm trying to clean up my life. I'm trying to do right, and this isn't paying off for crap. So I got to the hotel. I went to the restaurant, and I ordered a drink. And the lady looked down at me, and she said, I'm sorry, dear, it's election day. And it was like a phone call from the governor, you know. I didn't have enough sense. I didn't have anything going for me. But I got a reprieve. I got enough time given to me for sanity to return. But what happened was I just sat there and laughed and looked at the lady, and I thought, boy, wait till Mac hears this one. You know? But what I would like to report to you about all of that is that if you will do that for a period of time in your life, just pay attention to the coincidences that occur. Pay attention. And then start thinking, what are the chances of that? And what I did not realize was that he was really leading me into and through the second step for me to experience that something was going on here, and it wasn't me. I knew for sure I wasn't doing it, but I swear something was happening. And if you accumulate that kind of evidence, pretty soon you'd just be stupid to think that there wasn't something going on. But I did think there was, and I was getting to feel pretty good about all of this. What happens to me, though, is if I start feeling good, I I have a tendency to say, okay, I'll take it from here, you know. I'll get back to you if I need you. So I acted like I always act. I was stupid and went back to flitting in and out and all that kind of business. But that frightened me. I could see that I was getting into bad shape. And I looked in the grapevine, and I don't think that's how I found out about it. I think I saw a flyer, but it talked about an international young people's conference that was being held in Toronto, Canada. And I knew I needed to do something more. I was going to meet. I was doing what I knew to do, but I was itchy and I was scared and I knew I needed to do something else. I made a plan to go to that Young People's International. And I got a note when I registered, and it said, hope you'll enjoy the conference, on to Toronto, Don R., the co-chairman. And it took me 3 days to drive from Annapolis to Toronto, and I don't know why. But it was a wonderful experience for me. I had incredible things happen. The old person was dying, I had a lot of stuff going on, and it was a good thing. I got there, I was knocked out by the experience. There were, especially the California young people, they were having the best time, and I could see their joy. They were having a great time, and their lives were not over. They were not grousing and moaning about having to go to meetings and stuff. It was very attractive to me. And as I started to listen to all of the speakers and the workshops and panels and stuff, sometimes there was more than one thing going on, I went crazy. I didn't want to miss anything. If there was a speaker over here and a panel over there, I went nuts. But at any rate, it was such a fantastic experience for me. And usually I don't do things like thank anybody for anything. It wasn't part of my arsenal. I wasn't aware enough. You know, my world ended here. It didn't occur to me that a lot of people had put stuff like that on or anything. But I did. I found that the person who had written that note onto Toronto, Don R., I found him, and he was one of the speakers, and I went up to him after he talked, and I said, you're the reason I'm here, and I thank you. And that was August 4th of 1968. We got married on August 31st of 1968. Do the math. It's about 3 weeks. And so Don went back to Denver, and I went back to Annapolis to tell Mac. But, you know, and we were in touch and all like that. But the worst was when I was flying out to Denver for our wedding, and it occurred to me, God, I hope I recognize him when I get off the plane. So I did. And we had a lovely time in Denver. Our wedding reception was at the 1311 York Street, which is the great big AA clubhouse in Denver. And Don was very, very, very active in AA. And he was an old timer. He was almost 3 years sober. And I didn't count the slips that he'd had before or anything like that. But some of it had to do. I think in one way I was taking out some insurance, but I also felt like that it was the right thing, and I don't have any quarrel with that to this day. Pretty soon though, Don wanted to move to Texas. Well, I really didn't want to move to Texas, but my pattern was to just not say anything. I would stand there, and Don would speak for us. He didn't do that to me. I did that. He would say, we think this, and I would just stand there. And I was Mrs. Don. And if he thought that was a good meeting, I thought it was a good meeting. And if we ought to go answer the phone down at Intergroup, I thought so too. Whatever. I was just Mrs. Don. I just abdicated. I surrendered my identity. I surrendered all of the things that were important to me. And he wanted to move to Whitney, Texas. I got to Whitney, Texas, and it was hot. can't begin to tell you, for days. It was dry, dust, bugs. It was a whole different world for me, and I really didn't want to do that. But there was a redeeming factor. What was there was this couple named Bob and Marceline W. And they, because they lived there, there was a pocket of enthusiasm. They were a wonderful AA couple. Bob was alcoholic. Marceline was a very strong Al-Anon. And they were so charismatic that a community had kind of built up around them. And that's why Don wanted to go and live there. So that's where we moved. Soon after that, Don drank again. I think he probably was afraid that he was going to drink and wanted to live in Texas as one method. But he wasn't able to stay sober. What happened for me was that this real strong platform that I thought I was standing on was nothing. I had no program of my own. All that I knew about my dad's alcoholism, about my own alcoholism, about marrying an alcoholic went out the window, and I was a lunatic. I was a crazy person. I was the worst potential Al-Anon you ever saw. And soon after that, and Don would get sober 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and it was awful. I went to this Bob, and also Don's ex-wife had died. We inherited two of his my stepchildren. And I was supposed to be functioning as the resident adult, and I couldn't pull it together. I was competing with these kids. It was a really messy, awful thing. These kids had lost their mother. I was mad. I was mad at her for dying. And I could not cope. I couldn't put it. Couldn't stay strung together. I went to Bob to get some help. He said, "You really need to talk to Marcy. She can help you." And I thought, Christ, I got serious trouble here. I don't need an Al-Anon. Thank God for Marcy. She just held me together. This is the lady who took me through the rest of my steps. For the first time, she had me write an inventory, and I didn't have enough focus to write a grocery list, and she had me writing an inventory. That's the thing, though, with Al-Anons. You cannot negotiate with those folks. She was not hard or mean or nasty. She was simply firm. She said, "This is what it says, and that's why we do it." And she simply, you know, I could call her again when I got it done. And so I did. I found myself doing all of that stuff. I did everything she told me to do because I didn't have much else going. The good part was, too, though, that she actually told me things to say to the kids. She would give me the words. I would go over to her house at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning and just stand on her doorstep and cry until I thought it was a reasonable time, and then she'd let me in. And I'd tell her, you know, "Amy got ballpoint pen on the bedspread," and, you know, I was going to kill her for that. And Marceline would give me the words to say so as I could go back home and try and stay as decent a parent as I could make. Eventually, I wanted Don. We knew about this place way upstate New York. It was kind of a recovery facility, but it was really a spiritual community with deep, deep, deep AA roots. And I knew that if he could go there, they would fix him and then send him back and it'd be okay. Well, I kept after him and kept after him, and he wasn't ready to punch in. So I finally, at 4 years of hanging on by a thread and marshaling, keeping my act together, I called up there and I said, "You know, I live with an active alcoholic. I haven't had a drink in 4 years, but I'm the one that's crazy here. I'm in terrible shape. Would you be able to help me?" And they said, "Sure." And I went up there. I went there for the basic stay, and it was a very rigorous community. This was not Silver Hill. This was get up at 5 in the morning, chant from the Psalms, run a mile, peel carrots, spray paint, truth groups, the whole, it was, and God knows I needed it. I really needed it. And I stayed up there for the 2 months, and they helped me a lot. I finally took a decent inventory up there. The one that I had taken with Marceline brought me to the, kept me in the community, you know, in the realm where I was, could get some more help. But what I didn't, you know, I didn't even know that there was a fourth column. My whole first inventory was about everything anybody had ever done to me, and I had them down and what they did. Page after page of these pathetic resentments. I didn't put sex because that's not in good taste. I didn't want to talk about it, and so I didn't include it. So, but when I got to Eastridge, they had me do a fearless and thorough moral inventory. And then I had to take my fifth step with a member of the community, and I had to make the list to get ready for my amends. It was a wonderful experience for me. And, you know, no radio, no TV. You're off coffee, cigarettes, sugar, everything the day you get there, everything. And I needed all of that. Here's what happened, this big, big difference. I went back to Texas, and that's not me. Up until that point in my life, if something was too tough for me, I ran, or I lied, or I drank. That was my firmly entrenched pattern. And this time I went back and did what I believed I was supposed to do. And thank God, I still have a wonderful relationship with those kids today. Soon after that, Don and I had our own son. And then finally Don did decide to turn himself in to Eastridge. But he went up for the basic stay. And they did help him a great deal. But see, a basic difference in us is Don would get into things up to here. I would only stick my toe in the water. He dove all the way in. He wanted to become a member of the community. And I didn't want to live like that. That's the emergency room. You don't live in the emergency room, you know. You just go up there, you get patched up, you go back, and you live your life. Well, he decided he wanted to live up there as a permanent member of the community. So he bought a house. He took a Polaroid of it. What more could I want? You know, I get a picture of the house that I'm going to go move to. So anyway, we moved to upstate New York. We were in Texas for about 5 years. Our son was born there, and eventually I came to love Texas so very much because of the people. The people kept me hung together so well. They were wonderful, wonderful, open, big, generous, wonderful, loving people. I went through a period of time where I was such a snot about the big book. You know, you better not mispronounce something or get names interchanged or something. I would sit there and just be so critical during a meeting because there was the program and the fellowship and the line was clear. And yeah, there is a difference, but you know what? When I'm in desperate straits, it's been the people, it's been the fellowship that has carried me through till I can draw a sane breath again. At any rate, next we're off to upstate New York. This place, when I was in the community, there was no TV because they didn't want for us to have TVs or radios or anything. But then when we lived as part of the, you know, in the town, there was no TV except for one channel in black and white in the winter when the leaves were off the trees. We were that far out of everything. We were very, very far away. There was a little weeny town called Hankins, but we didn't even live in the town. We lived outside of the town. And there was an AA meeting in Calicoon. It was a good drive. But I went to the AA meeting. Don was part of the community, and he was being ferocious with his spiritual development. And I went into the town to the AA meeting. There were four guys and a lady that smoked cigars. And they sat around, and they were talking about how tough it was to get a job. And it was in the basement of the bank. And I thought, oh, geez, I'm not going to make it here. I started crying and driving home. I called Marceline. I said, I'm not going to make it here. They don't even know about the big book. It's a rumor up here. They don't, yeah. This is terrible. I'm not going to make it. She said, will you go back next week and be sure you bring your book? But she did that with everything for me. She always gave me things to do that kept me out of my own way. She gave me specific instructions, and God, that helped. When we were talking just before the meeting, Beth was saying how it's difficult to talk casually, socially, you know, a little chit-chat when you go out for dinner or that when you get together and in these kind of gatherings. I couldn't stand these kind of gatherings when I very first came in. I would hide. There's a pillar out there. I'd be standing behind it. I think it was the nervous system and all. But I told Marceline that is that I was scared. I didn't like people to come up and touch me and say how glad they were I was there. Get away from me. Leave me alone. And so she gave me a mission. I was to thank the speaker. And Don, of course, wanted to go to every conference there was. So we went to conferences, and I would just be a mess. So she gave me that direction. So I would have to get in line after the speaker and thank them. Well, then I had to start listening to what they said because I would want to go say something sensible when I got up there. And then I would be standing in line and I would be talking to people while I was standing in line. And I didn't realize that all of those things were making me more and more comfortable on my own of meeting the people in the rooms. But she did that for every single thing that I went to her with. I went to her with a problem and she gave me specific ways to go about acting better and different. And like Clancy was saying last night, it's the actions. You don't have to believe it. Just do it. If you do it, you get changed. Let's see. By about, I looked for a sponsor up there. I could not find one. There wasn't anybody there, so I was still pretty tight with Marcy. But a lady who had a very thick British accent, thicker even than Michelle, came up to me and asked if I would sponsor her. And we were well into that relationship before I realized that that was the answer to my prayer. I didn't even know how much about Alcoholics Anonymous I had actually experienced and was able to help her with, which of course helped me. It was a wonderful thing. And pretty soon, though, Don, the glow wore off the community for him. And he then decided that he wanted to move to Nashville, Tennessee and start his business up again. And by then, we'd been married 10 years and then the marriage had run out of gas. There's a lot of been too much damage, I'm afraid. So I said, well, that's it for me. So he went to Nashville. I went back to school. I went back to college at 40, which was scary, I'm telling you. We sold the house around this time. I was just about 10 years. My dad died, the divorce, sell the house, move, go back to school. I had more than I could manage. The 11th year of my sobriety was the best of times and the worst of times. When it gets that bad, I don't have a prayer. So what do? I pray. I don't, and I really was fervent in my prayer, and I did try at that point to start living intuitively, to be shown what was my next step to take, and do what I felt moved was my right thing to do next, and it was wonderful. It was scary, but it was wonderful. So I was there with my 5-year-old. I went to a school in Wilkesboro, Pennsylvania. I got my report card, my first quarter, and I called back to Bob and Marcy in Texas, and I said, I think you're going to be proud. And they said, we already were. And I thought, you know, that's the God's truth. They have always treated me that way. I never had to earn anything with them. And that was one of my misconceptions. I thought I had to justify my existence. I thought I had to give you a reason why I should be allowed to take up space on the earth and breathe in the air. And they never treated me like that. And that was another big turning for me. I graduated very well. I got a job. I worked as a physician assistant for the next 20 years. And that's a wonderful thing for a washout, burnout, bummed out loser. I got a job in Illinois. A couple of years after that, there was a TWIX, a communication that comes through the federal system that absolutely, completely, perfectly described what I was doing and said that there was an opening in Providence, Rhode Island. And that was clear to me. It's time to go home. That was in 1985. I went to the International in Montreal and then moved to Rhode Island. And I'm so very, very grateful that I got to do that. I came back as a sane grown-up with my son. We settled into Rhode Island. I got to begin to mend and patch and repair a lot of the old damage that I'd done in person, and to get to know my family, what was left by then. And I started to get active in service. One of the things that Bob White always said was, Bob always said was, the extension of gratitude is action. Don't just sit around and tell us how grateful you are. What's the evidence? What's the demonstration of that? He always had us doing stuff. He's one who always said, you carry this message. Don't wait for somebody to come to your door. And so we did actively reach out and look for people to carry the message to. And so I began to get active in the service structure. I was told that my group didn't have a general service representative. I didn't even know what that was. But I was sober about 20 years almost by then, and I didn't want to let anybody know. So I, you know, like I always do, as long as I could dummy up, you know, and fake it. So, but I learned more about what that was, and I got to be the general service representative for my group, and I started going to the district meetings, and boy, I hated that. We were saying before I'd rather be in a street fight than a business meeting. There are people who thrive on that. I am not one of them. But I seemed to keep getting the jobs, and so pretty soon I was doing cooperation with the professional community, and that seemed like something that was worth doing to me. It seemed like to try and carry the message to people who might run into an active alcoholic in the course of their day, like that old gynecologist that tried to help me, and psychiatrists and nurses and union shop stewards and lawyers and anybody who might run into an alcoholic. We want them to know what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Would they like to go to a meeting? That kind of thing. I thought that was worthwhile work to do. So I did that for about 4 years on the area committee in Rhode Island. And then it was time for another election, and I stood for delegate, and I got elected. That was the most exciting thing. It was amazing to me to be delegated by the AAs in Rhode Island to be their representative at the General Service Conference, which happens once a year, every year, in April in New York, where AA does its business, all of its business. Every dime is accounted for to the satisfaction of the delegates. I mean, it's not we and they. It's us. They're all there. Every jerk you ever met in AA is there, you know. Their representative is there. And there's a proportionate amount. You know, there's a sprinkling of people that you can't. You say, what's he doing here? You know? And then I say, oh, geez, they probably think, what am I doing here? But there's also a sprinkling of extraordinarily inspiring, wonderful, wonderful people. So it was a great experience, and I did that for 2 years. In Rhode Island, after you serve as the delegate, you automatically become the state convention chair. So I got to do that. I loved doing that. This kind of planning an event, I think these are so worthwhile. Celebrations, joy, together. They're exciting and wonderful. And I could remember, too, the first young people. So at any rate, that was another opportunity this is a funny thing. Whenever I've done anything in service, I always feel like, I hear people saying all the time, well, it's payback. That's really not true. For me, it is so rewarding. I heard somebody say one time, it's like God is some kind of cosmic loan shark. you try and pay back, but you get so much more that then you got to pay so much more, and then you get so much more. You can't ever break even with the benefits that just continue to just shower on you if you get out of the house and go and do. Get in the car and go get over there and go, and don't expect to be entertained. Just go see what you can do to help. It's amazing, and it's overwhelming the kind of incredible influence that it's been in my life. After that, there was another election. I was eligible to stand as for Rhode Island's candidate for a Northeast Regional Trustee. And that was in 1995, and I was elected. I bumble an awful lot, but if I try to begin to tell you about that, you'll see someone standing here just blithering and stammering. It was such an extraordinary experience that I really am hard-pressed to begin to describe that. What's a trustee? Well, there's 21 trustees who serve Alcoholics Anonymous on the General Service Board. The General Service Board is what replaced the what Bill first started up, the Alcoholic Foundation. And the trustees are ultimately responsible for being Bill saw clearly that he and Dr. Bob weren't going to be around forever, so he established the Alcoholic Foundation and the General Service Conference to be what would ultimately handle Alcoholics Anonymous into the future. The conference is the communication between the trustees of the General Service Board and the delegates, who of course are from our groups, from our districts, from our areas. So it really, really is a democracy. Nobody's handing down edicts from on high. Everything comes from the groups. And the groups give us our marching orders. And the word gets passed. And the board is responsive to what the fellowship wants for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that if you don't have a service job, that you'll get one. It doesn't have to be a GSR. It doesn't have to have any letters after it. There's nobody any more important than the greeter, I don't think. Maybe coffee maker, I don't know. You could make a case for both. But there's a zillion jobs, and they're worth doing. And so that experience, though, has just been amazing for me. What a trip. Honest to God. The people who have brought me to this day, I'm very conscious of them. Sometimes they're riding in the car with me. Sometimes they're standing at a business meeting with me. The people, I'm very, very much aware. When I was so touched last night when Clancy talked about Dr. Bob's last talk, you know, that people took the time with me. And that has been my experience. Very wonderful, kind, generous people have taken their time with me through all these years. And Bill had an expression, you know, he said AA was not a success story in the regular sense of that word. It's a story of terrible failure, transmuted by a loving God into what we see, which has changed the course of history, not just for us. Alcoholics Anonymous has had a genuine historical impact on our civilization. And it was a bunch of totally helpless failures. One of the most significant books I read in the last year was The Spirituality of Imperfection. When things are so difficult and you turn to a loving God and He's there. And that's what I think I bear witness to, is that when I was running my own show, it was a pathetic horror. It was just an unraveling wreck. And God's grace through Alcoholics Anonymous has turned it into something that I feel wonderful about, I'm grateful for, I'm so glad to be with more of my friends this weekend. I didn't know you before. I feel like I do now, and I thank you so very much for your attention and for your sharing and for your love and attention this weekend. Thanks very much.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.